So, I'm Dan Moore, for those of you who don't know me. I've been going to Imago since either the first or second week at Gateway, and I never met in the basement. I am not going to talk to you about the Bible today. I do not feel like I am an expert on that in any shape or form, and I think we talked about the Bible enough last week that Charlie will still meet his 90% quota. But I am going to talk to you about people, because I do think I'm kind of a people expert, because, one, I am a person, which I know that meets almost everybody, but I'm also a school teacher, so I come into contact with a lot of unique people throughout pretty much my career, approximately 120 different teenage people every year, and I know adult people normally should be different than teenagers, but we know they're not. And, you know, I teach social studies, so not only do I teach, but I also teach about people, both history and economics and, you know, all the social studies, and I'm sure you guys all love those classes. In addition to a little bit about me, I'm on the Enneagram. I went to that conference a couple weeks ago, months ago, and I found out that I was a 9, and that was surprising to me because I was pretty sure I was a 5 because I really enjoy learning. But then upon reflection, I learned that a lot of the learning that I like to learn is based upon trying to figure out how to solve problems. So the problems of the world, the problems of microcosmic people. And so, first let me just say, I admire Imago Dei Church for many reasons, but one of the many reasons that I admire them is that we do show up. It is, some of you guys might not know, it's Super Bowl Sunday, and the main pastor is not here, and yet there's really not a seat available in the place, which is, it's a testament to the fact that we do come to church pretty religiously. So, yes, I know. So first, a little bit about my church history, because, of course, since we as well are an 8-year-old church, and almost everybody in the room is older than 8, we all have a church history, right? We all have a place where we started our church journey, where we then moved to another church, and then we moved to a different church, and we all have that, right? So when I was born into a Baptist church, Bethel Baptist in Pekin. I don't remember much about it other than I really wanted to be dunked in that tank and see how long I could hold my water, or hold my breath, not my water. Which would be weird. So, because by that point in time, I started swimming, you know, and I was like, man, I bet I could hold it for like 3 minutes. I'd stay under there. They'd think I was dead. And then I would like jump out like, hello, you know. So, and I remember that I would crawl under the pews and my parents would be embarrassed. But I don't remember. That's about it, because we left when I was 8 or 9. And then we went to a Presbyterian church, Mainline First United Presbyterian Church of Pekin, Illinois, USA, which is one of the many denominations of Presbyterianism. And I went there pretty much through high school, went off to college, of course, and so I didn't attend regularly when I was at college. And then I came back and went to there again until I moved out and moved to Peoria. And then I started attending Northwoods Church, which is where I got hooked into the people that eventually kind of went to Imago. So, which is where I've been, like I said, since second week at the Gateway. So, what am I here to talk to you today about? Well, for the most part, I'm here. Here's a spoiler for the end, you know. So, we history teachers like to do that. We like to give the end and then say, and then this is how it happened. It's pretty much to be nice. which is a pretty easy message, right? We all should be nice. But it's a little bit harder when we're actually trying to put it into practice. And so I guess you could call my sermon the Holy Catholic Church, small c, because for the most part, as a 8-year-old church, we have a history of a lot of people that have come from a lot of different denominations, and therefore we left those denominations for a reason. Right, we are at Imago Dei for a different reason. And so what happens as just in general is it's the same reason we give up something, like if we gave up chocolate or if we gave up bread or dairy or fatty foods or fast food or Facebook, whatever we decide to give up, we then like naturally feel proud of the fact that we gave that up. And therefore, we feel like we should be negative about the thing that we gave up. And so it is natural to always say, man, I used to go to this one church, but let me tell you why I don't go there anymore. And it's usually, it never starts with, because Imago Dei is so awesome, you know, which it is. But that's not always the full story. It's usually like, well, because this church does... And I'm trying not to say anything negative because that would ruin my whole message. but I'm sure you guys can imagine right now kind of the things that people will say about their old churches that are the negatives of their old churches. And so the thing is that there's a lot of positives about all the churches that are in Peoria. There's a lot of positives about the previous churches that you went to. Even if you don't attend there anymore, doesn't mean that it's not a good place. And the reason I kind of came to this personal epiphany was a few years ago, I was in a place where I was thinking about all this church history, and I teach a class called AP European History, which pretty much... Europe is kind of where the Reformation happened, and that's kind of like the beginning of my class, and I'm focusing on all these things like that divides churches. And I'm thinking about all the people and I talk to some of my friends, and they're like, they tell me all about why they like their church, and you kind of get this imagining of, well, that doesn't sound like something I would like at all. But I am not them, and they are not me. And so, since we know that God is vast, and God is too vast for us to even fully comprehend the vastness of God, we have to imagine that each church is almost like specifically designed to reach its own parishioners. And so, the church that I used to go to, that I did not feel alive in, I like the connecting, you know, the way Imago communicates during the sermon, the way we talk. It's kind of like a Bible study. And since, as you know, I kind of wanted to be a 5 and I was a 9. The learning, to me, just makes it feel like this is where I'm supposed to be. But that doesn't mean that if I try to bring everybody from my old church here, they're going to be like, yes, I love that we talk during service. This is the best thing. Why didn't we ever think of this at our church? Because it just wouldn't reach the people that are supposed to be going to that church. And so God, I believe, designs churches to reach the most amount of people that he can. And so we can't, as a church body, say, well, we have the right way, because I feel like this church is doing it better than my old church, because I feel more alive in this church than I did in my old church. And so then it becomes a, this is, we have arrived mentality that then leads to negativity. And so I guess it's hard for us, like, because it is a literal impossibility to be universally accepting of all people. right? I mean, but it's not because, I mean, you got the whole neo-Nazi and Jewish argument. Like, how is a Jew supposed to accept a neo-Nazi? Like, he's like, yeah, you're allowed to believe that I should die. You know, and I accept your belief that I shouldn't exist. That's a hard, you know, and that's just an extreme, of course, because that's the other thing history teachers like to do. But you understand what I'm saying. So, like, as we're journeying through this general, like, generous orthodoxy is a great theory in terms of we're trying to accept all believers into our body, but that then means, like, are you going to accept believers who don't believe we should be accepting all believers? You know, therein lies the crux of generous orthodoxy, because how does that look, right? And I think deep down we all kind of have that tension that we're trying to hold in perpetuity, you know, like, yes, we know that's the hard part. Like, how do we accept people that don't think we should accept other people? And so it's a hard, you know, like, how generous can we be in our orthodoxy in terms of accepting? But then at the same time, we do need to still love them. And if we want to have a generous orthodoxy, then maybe the people that don't want to have a generous orthodoxy should have a different church, and we shouldn't, like, begrudge them for leaving. We shouldn't say, oh, I can't believe they left. We thought that they wanted to be accepting of people. I guess they're not. And then I can't believe that they're saying that we are not Christians because they're the ones that are bad. But then yet we really, as a teacher, I always tell people, we can't change other people. We can only change ourselves and how we react to other people. And so what we need to do is we need to just, like, if people do leave 5 weeks from now, whenever, we need to just say, you know what? That's okay. I hope they find a church that will, they'll reach them where they are, and they will be able to do good in the world, which is what we want to do as a church. So basically what I'm trying to say is, when you talk about your other faiths, when you talk about other denominations, try to be a little bit more positive. Try to focus more on, you know, like, the things you like about your past denominations. Try to focus on the things that you want people to know about why you went there for so long, not the reasons why you decided to leave. And if you do, just focus on the nice things about Imago, because there's enough nice things about Imago that you don't have to say anything negative about your church in your conversations. You can say only positive things about Imago, and then say, and these are the things I liked about my old church. I just like these Imago a little bit better. And that's where we can leave it. And because I also don't think it would be disingenuous if we expected other churches not to badmouth us if we continue, or not that anybody's doing it. I'm not blaming you, because I know I've done it as well. Okay, I'm blaming me. But it would be disingenuous to say, I can't believe those other churches are saying that we are this, if we then turn around and say they are that. Because, again, we can't change what they say about us, but we can change what we say about them. So that's my message.
Thank you very much. I am also going to talk about community. So Dan and I didn't know what our topics were, so they paired together really well. So I found this interesting study a few months back. It's called 36 Questions to Love. Did anyone see it? It was going around New York Times. It was actually a study that was about 20 years ago done by a psychologist. And the question was, can you, in a laboratory setting, escalate or speed up the time that it takes to become intimate with someone? Can two random strangers, after about an hour and 36 questions, come to have maybe a drawn to each other, an attraction? And there are actually several cases where participants ended up getting married. And so it's really interesting. So there was a lady who did some research about this. And the idea was that these questions would they would start pretty shallow and then quickly move to more intimate, more personal questions. But it was happening so seamlessly that people wouldn't realize, and they wouldn't be afraid to share. And it was back and forth, so people would both be answering the same questions. So there wasn't this fear of being vulnerable. And so it was a really fascinating study. And I think there's some podcast that's going to come out about it. But Google 36 questions to love. I think the lady who's rehashing this study, she said question number 37, wedding, big or small, is kind of like the joke, because it's so helpful. So this was one of the quotes from the research. The idea is that mutual vulnerability fosters closeness. If you're any of you are Brene Brown fans, some of that rings true. To quote the study's authors, one key pattern associated with the development of a close relationship among peers is these things altogether: sustained, escalating, reciprocal, personal self-disclosure. So I'll read that. This is research talk, but so it's sustained. It's over the course of an hour. It's escalating. It's going deeper and deeper, becoming more intimate. It's reciprocal. It's a give and take, back and forth. Personal self-disclosure. Allowing oneself to be vulnerable with another person can be exceedingly difficult, so this exercise forces the issue. And so I found this fascinating, and I think it teaches us that, it's kind of interesting, because we know inherently that relationships, that there's giving and receiving, that there's a give and take, that there is, it's not just purely selfish motives. It's not all about me, but it's about both. Marriage doesn't really work if you're just asking, how much can I get out of this relationship? If it's too lopsided, that doesn't work, but it's a mutuality. And so I was trying to think this week, like, then why, when we approach community as a church or our friendship circles, do we often ask the question, how do I find community? It's a consumer posture rather than one that we're giving community. And so maybe the question instead is, where can I offer community? Because just like in the study, both people are offering that self-disclosure, and both people are then finding the intimacy. So anyway, I was just fascinated with this idea of the community, that that instead of asking, how do I find community, where can I offer community? And because the beauty is that both ended up having it in that. And so Christina and I actually discovered this out by accident. At our last church, when we first started going to that church, we were relatively new. Maybe we've been married for 3 years or so, 2 years. And we had not had really any good couple friends, any married couple friends that we were really close to. And so we were really, really craving that. And so we went to this church, and they had this like table full of all these small groups. And there was one that was for like young married couples. And we're like, amazing, this is awesome. We're going to find community here. And so we did. It was called Kaleo, because all the small groups there had names, which is like a Greek word. I don't know what it means. Do you know what it was? Kaleo, Greek word. The called ones, something like that. So it was amazing. We just the culture of the group was exactly what we needed. There was this pool of like 12 other people that were in a similar stage of life with a similar desire for community, and so we just loved it. It was like every week. And then, but the problem was that too many people liked it. And so there was one week where there were 28 people at the group in a house. It was like a 3-bedroom house. And so there was 28 people in this small group, and which doesn't work. And so unfortunately, in that couple month span, they found out that Christina and I were both seminary students. And so when they were looking across the group as to who can start a group in this group, who can break off, they forced us to. And so we were not really wanting to go. But we were like, all right, I guess we will, after much deliberation. Because they were basically saying, you have to leave, or you could start a group. And so they kind of helped us launch this other group. So it wasn't really an option, but it was presented that way. No, anyway. So then we started a group called Zoe, which is also a Greek word, meaning life. And we had no idea at the time that it was going to be a trade-up. It felt like a huge sacrifice. We were not really interested in doing it. We didn't know anyone in the group. So there was, we felt like we were leaving all the people that we knew, that we liked, that we had affinity with, and then, you know, providing this group for everyone else that was adding to the group continually. And those people are still some of our closest friends. Something beautiful happened, that we took the risk of creating community, and people found community, and we found community. And so we'll take trips there. And so we see this dynamic. And I'm not trying to, in this soapbox, trying to negate the frustration of not finding a community, or the hurt, or the turmoil of that lack of fulfillment in relationships that many of us have felt, and hopefully all of us have felt at times. Otherwise, we probably don't know what we're missing. But I'm just trying to say that maybe we're approaching it the wrong way. There's a book called Barefoot Church, and it's a little bit, it's hard to see, I guess, but so look at where it's underlined. It says, since then, we've learned that when we seek community, we may or may not end up finding it. But whenever we lock our arms together for the sake of mission, we inevitably find community with those we serve with. This is a church, we read this several years ago, and then we've been reading it recently. And it's fascinating because it illustrates this fact a little bit. And it also, I think, it gives two other layers. One, when we think of mission, when we think of Jesus being a force for good in the world, and us trying to emulate him and being his hands and feet, we're outreach focused. So why not apply that same sacrificial posture in regards to community? You know, it comes so easily for us. And then also, if you just look at Jesus' life, he had a posture of serving rather than consuming. So it makes me wonder, how much does our culture shape our view of community? The scriptures also have a lot to say. So it's you know, you guys have heard the one another's in scripture. There's 59 I found on this list, and I can only screenshot, 20 of them. But be at peace with one another, love one another, love one another, love one another, serve one another, show hospitality to one another. When you come together, eat, wait for each other. The scripture is, it really speaks to this mutuality. But I also like that this, it doesn't just say that it's a mutual relationship, but it says that each of us has something to offer. That oftentimes we'll feel like we're inadequate, or that we're not, we need to find someone else who's interesting, or find a community that's thriving, because we don't have the ability to foster that on our own, or to build that community, or friendship to give, you know, that we're, it's like, we're, I don't know, we're always playing somewhat, it's we're tempted to play the passive role. So I think that I'm encouraged by the one another's in scriptures, because it says, the people around me, they need a listening ear. That we can offer hospitality, that we can be a shoulder for someone who's going in a hard time, that we can be the first one to say, how's your week going? That we can say, what's going on? And pay attention instead of always being, you know, trying to be the one to talk first, but maybe to listen first. So if you desire more community in your life, try offering it to someone else this week. That's all.